but yes, there are still traces of oil at a number of places throughout the beach area.
Satisfactory with environmental officials up there?
Well, there is, there is an environmental balance, I would suggest to you, and there is, of course, the natural ecosystem can handle a certain amount of oil. And you have to balance at some point in these very beautiful, very pristine areas, whether you're doing more good or harm by being on these shorelines with a harsh cleanup technique.
But is this satisfactory? What you're doing, your plan, is that satisfactory with the officials up there right now?
The plan we have, and each plan we have, has been approved by the federal government. The current plan is approved by the federal government.
Up there?
Yes, sir.
So there is no disagreement or no discrepancy between what you're doing and what they think you should be doing?
We have approved plans. I can't tell you that we're always unanimous at all times, but I can tell the plan is fully approved.
Okay, and there will be something done to in the future, whether it's this winter or next summer, whatever, there will be something done to help the environment up there and those people to a satisfactory acceptance of what they want, correct?
Well, I'm not sure what that question is, but we are continuing to work with the federal government, with the state government, in fact, a total of 14 agencies in the state and federal scene, and to cooperate in every way possible.
As a matter of fact, we'll have additional guests later on in the day who can speak to those kinds of problems from the state and federal perspective. Our guest right now, though, is Otto Harrison. He's Exxon's top cleanup man in Alaska right now, and this is your chance to talk to him. On the line right now, we have Al Manville, who is the executive director of the group known as Defenders of Wildlife. He spent really more than a month on the scene here, looking at it from an environmental perspective. Al Manville, you're on the line with Otto Harrison, and this is your chance to talk.
Thank you, Steve. I'm Mr. Harrison. Actually, I'm not executive director, I'm senior staff wildlife biologist for the record. Question on the technologies that are being used versus those not being used in Alaska. I understand that, of course, you've been very interested in the corrective products and bioremediation is currently ongoing, is that correct?
Yes, sir. As you're probably aware, we have tested some 23 beach cleaners, of which corrective happened to be one of those. But we're very interested in those processes as well as a number of mechanical processes.
Well, I guess my question revolves around a number of products that have proven and very promising track records elsewhere. You may have heard of some of them, Bioversal products from West Germany, Active 8000 made by Panther Technologies here in Connecticut, Wolastic made by FP Wool Company. And these products have worked well in other oil spill situations, broken oil down. In the case of Bioversal, was a little 6 days, and yet I don't hear any testing of these products. Can you shed some light on that?
There is some work and some testing going on in a number of places, but one of the reasons that we wound up with a bioremediation approach that we did is that, fortunately, EPA had some work already underway in that area. All of our testing procedures to get through the agencies and the regional response teams here take a period of testing in the field of virtually 2 months. So that step has to be considered. And in addition, we wanted to do those things that best fit with the natural environment. We thought using the natural microbes that were in the area was probably a very sound overall fit. The products that we're using are very non-toxic and very compatible.
The corrective is not, but you're of course not pushing it now, but that's exactly the situation with Bioversal and Active 8000. They're environmental denying. The Bioversal product, approved by our counterpart of EPA in West Germany, the Institute of Hygiene, and they approved it for use in water that's actually being used later on for treatment for drinking water purposes, so it's pretty safe. And it's got a proven technology, a proven track record, and I know I've been approached by a number of these companies and passed the information on to you folks, and it seems like nothing has happened. And it's very frustrating. These technologies may be far and above ahead of the rock rubbing and beach squirting, as it's been called by some up there, that were used for months and months, and yet haven't heard any real positive approach to trying these, because I guess perhaps they're not Exxon products.
Having an Exxon product has nothing to do with it. As you know, bioremediation is not an Exxon product. But let me go on and express share a couple of thoughts with you. Any application has to be unique to this oil, to these waters, to these temperatures, to these rocks, in the state that they currently exist. And standard off-the-shelf products, in many cases, may not fit this particular application. The testing will have to be specific. I'm not sure in my own mind that there's going to be universal products. I think we're going to be able to talk about the characteristics that we would all like to see in a cleanup. I think the likelihood of universal solutions, magical cures, are relatively low.
I agree with you. I think because of the tremendous extent of this oil spill, and documented now to have gone over 850 miles from Lyre Reef, and the changing composition of the oil from areas turning to asphalt is projected to be that situation on the surface next year, it's quite a problem. But what I'm suggesting is that you try some of these promising technologies elsewhere. My understanding, for example, that with bioremediation, you have to remove at least 80% of the oil before you can even use it effectively. And I've heard reports of oil now as deep as 8 feet below the surface into the substrate. So it's got a real serious problem and an extreme difficulty in getting this stuff. So my suggestion is, and as I said before, there are a lot of other technologies out there that deserve testing. And who knows, there may be something there that will work in some of these areas, but it's got to be tried. And my feeling is that Exxon has not given it the best shot possible.
Well, I hope that we can allay your concern in that. We do have a very active research program through the community. And our research facility in New Jersey, which is Exxon Research and Engineering, will be working on chemical aspects, direct chemical and physical chemistry aspects during this wintertime. Our research facility in Houston, Exxon Production Research, will be working on physical and mechanical aspects of other cleanup devices. We have a fairly active program. We're specifically aiming at this oil and these beaches for this winter.
I want to thank Al Manville for joining us, and we also want to thank Otto Harrison for joining us in the studio this morning. He's the general manager of the Exxon Corporation's Valdez operations.
At this point, we're going to change our focus to the nation's capital for a while. We continue to invite your participation by telephone in this nationwide call-in show. The number is 800-325-1100. Both houses of Congress have been moving rapidly toward making sure the nation's better prepared to deal with any future oil spill. Some would say the movement's been too rapid, and some of the legislation is flawed. With us from the studios of radio station WAMU in Washington is Peter Kenyon, a state capitol reporter for the Alaska Public Radio Network. Hello, Peter.
This program is made possible by APRN member stations, the Town Creek Foundation, and a grant from the American Public Radio Program Fund. Contributors include the Ford Foundation. This production is a partnership of the Alaska Public Radio Network and American Public Radio.
Alaska with Theo Pelosic, who's the Vice President of Operations at the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. As Vice President, he was responsible for both the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the terminal at Valdez at the time of the Exxon Valdez spill. He continues to have that responsibility. He also has a major role in spill planning and implementing those plans. before coming to Alyeska, Mr. Florasik worked almost 30 years for ARCO. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're glad to have you here. I think the kinds of questions that seem to be asked most now are what's in place? What's the current contingency plan? What are the protective measures in place right now to prevent another disaster of this kind?
We've taken some very major steps to improve our ability to prevent or certainly reduce the likelihood of another major catastrophic spill in the future. We've added, I think some of the key things we've done is we've added some escort response vessels. We have, I sense every vessel that's going out loaded has at least two vessels escorting it, usually one tug and one what we call an escort response vessel. Either of those vessels by itself can basically contain and can control the ship if it were to lose power. So if it gets in trouble, there's someone right on site to help. In addition, you have two different sets of eyes, independent sets of eyes that follow the ship. They're required, the escort response vessels are required to stay within a half mile of the tanker in its for the challenges. And they go all the way out to Hitchinburg, which is all the way out through Prince William Sound. Whereas previously we had a tanker escort just out through the Narrows. In addition, the escort response vessel has about 4,600 feet of boom on it, and some skimmers, and it's capable of making an immediate, almost a very rapid response to contain a spill if one occurs.
Say there were a breach in the tanker as serious as the one at the Exxon Valdez, and you talk about oil gushing out so strongly that it was actually pushing up above the water line quite a bit. Could these escort vessels contain that oil long enough to start pumping it out?
With that situation, I don't think there's any set of boom anywhere in the world that could hold it. Obviously, you could tune some of it, but some of it would get by in such a catastrophic situation. I think you have to understand that people can design systems to cope with things that are somewhat manageable. You know, when you release 260,000 barrels of oil within 5 hours or 6 hours, and have it spread over a very large area before daylight, it's an extremely difficult problem to cope with. And all we can say is we have equipment, we'll have skimmers, large skimmers, we have two efficient large skimmers, one that is called a wing boom kind of skimmer, a dynamic skimmer. We also have a wheel boom skimmer, so that once we corral the oil, we can do a very good job of picking it up.
People have talked about meeting disaster with almost warlike responses. One that was suggested by a caller earlier this morning was burning the whole thing. Why, this person asked, didn't Alyeska and Exxon simply boom off that vessel as it was gushing oil and set fire to the thing?
Well, obviously, it's a very difficult question when you're talking about having another million barrels of oil on the ship. One would have to ask himself, if I burn the 250,000 outside, am I likely to cause some greater catastrophe by releasing another million barrels?
Was that a question that was asked in the early hours?
I would suppose it was asked by Exxon. You have to understand that Alyeska's role is a first responder. Exxon very quickly took on its federally mandated responsibility to be responsible for making the decisions. They worked with the Coast Guard, who was in charge, along with Exxon, along with the state's involvement, what decisions you had made regarding lightering and so forth in the vessel. So, for instance, the Alyeska made the first response, and by 6 o'clock Friday evening, the Exxon managers, executives, decision-making people were on the scene, and we began the transition of control to them. So, those kind of discussions relate to burning, dispersants, public relations, and the lightering of the vessel was handled by Exxon. And Alyeska then gradually transitioned itself out of the response situation. They kept using our equipment and people until they had the money.
What would happen today if the exact same thing happened? What would happen in that authority chain? Would it once again go from you to the shipper?
Yes. The plan that we've submitted to the state clarifies what has been the federal law all along, and that is the spiller is the responsible party, and that we and Alyeska are the first response. And we'll do that. And the plan that we submitted to the state August 1, in effect, said that. Now, state law requires that each vessel that's coming in have an approved plan. And that plan then can include Alyeska as the first responder, telling the state how they intend to cope with the problem in the future. So in effect, we will have a clearer contractual relationship with the shippers and shippers than we had in the past. So that's the way it's worked.
You know, it seems like you're the ones, though, that will provide the consistency, basically, in the response. If everybody has its own different plan. Are you satisfied? I mean, is this the best of all possible worlds now? Do you think this is as good as the protection can get?
I think we've got excellent protection to say and to guarantee that you'd never have another catastrophe, and certainly don't think anyone in the world can do that. There's no question that with the double escort vessels, and if we get radar coverage that goes all the way out to Houston, and with the pilots going out, you know, we now have essentially five sets of eyes watching with two vessels alongside that can control a ship if it gets into trouble. In my mind, the thing that was most likely to be the bad thing that had ever happened to us is the ship would lose power out somewhere in Prince William Sound and drift on a rock before it could be assisted. Well, now we've set pretty well control of that exposure. And to say that there is something else that we haven't yet imagined that could happen, I can't say that. We have a really strengthened program. From the standpoint of prevention, I think it's just what's better than anything else in the world, without a doubt. In terms of our pickup capability, we have a better pickup capability than any other place in the world. Is it enough if you can dream up some horror story? I'm not sure. Because weather can mitigate the pickup capability of any equipment you have in the world.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Please stay with us, if you would. We earlier tried to connect with Washington, and we had a technical problem. We're ready to try again. APRN reporter Peter Kenyon is standing by there. Peter, can you hear us now?
Yes, Pat, can you hear us?
Yes, indeed we can.
Okay, great. Well, I'm here with George Frampton, who's president of the Wilderness Society, and Frank Murkowski, who is a senator from Alaska. And we were getting their reactions to what Alyeska and Exxon have been saying during the show. Mr. Frampton, from the wilderness community perspective, what do you think about what Alyeska has done and Exxon and what they plan to do?
Well, Peter, in spite of what the gentleman from Alyeska had to say, I think the one lesson above all that we need to take away from the last 6 months is this. Once a spill like this occurs, of this magnitude, 95% of the damage has been done. That is, it's inevitable, regardless of whether an A-plus cleanup is mounted or no cleanup. And we'll only have learned that lesson when we do two things. First, resolve to keep additional exploration and development for oil and gas out of pristine, ecologically sensitive environments, particularly in Alaska, at least for a decade. And that means, at the very least, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the rich fishery of Bristol Bay. And second, when we will have created a climate, an incentive for the oil companies to build in prevention, safety, contingency planning, training up front. In other words, a climate in which they have the incentive to invest in prevention at the outset, and that will require new significant liability legislation by Congress this month.
All right, Senator Murkowski, what is your reaction to what we've heard from Alyeska and Exxon so far about their role in trying to clean up this mess?
Well, I think the realization is that the job isn't complete. There have been as many as 10,000-11,000 Alaskans who have worked very, very hard. The weather is dictating the terms of the work. It's pretty difficult to extend the season much beyond this, so the realization is we're going to have to come back next spring, evaluate what Mother Nature has done, and make decisions. I think we're going to have to continue the cleanup beyond that, because the realization of that volume of oil and the damage that was done is every indication that will have to occur. I think I differ with George on the question of ANWR and exploration in Alaska, because this country is currently dependent on about 50% of its oil coming in from other nations. It comes in by tanker. The realization that you want to increase that means you're going to increase the maritime risk of additional maritime disasters. We saw what occurred on the East Coast this summer, three in one day. We don't know if there's oil in Anwar, but Anwar is a different situation than the Exxon Valdez. That was a maritime disaster. The question of the national energy security of our nation is at stake here, as we depend on foreign imports. Do we want to see gasoline lines around the block again? Do we want to have to depend on foreign oil? We've been held hostage before. It's of the national interest to know if it's there. It might not be there. You usually don't find it when you look for it.
Let's talk about it more in the short term, what is going to happen on the, as far as legislation from this oil spill. The Senate has passed a bill. The House is scheduled to act next week. We've seen this sort of thing before. The Argo Merchant, several years ago, there was a liability bill that died in the final days of Congress. Is that going to happen again this year?
No, I don't think so. I think there's a commitment by Congress to address a number of things associated with the movement of oil by the vessels along our coasts and in our coastal waters and coming from overseas. I've introduced legislation patterned after the Solonville port in Great Britain, the idea to try and bring together the citizens through local advisory committees that address the credibility gap that's been lost here as far as my state of Alaska is concerned, because we just had it from one side. We've had the assurance from industry. The idea of learning from somebody else's programs, namely what has happened over in Solonville, where you set up a citizens' council made up of fishermen, environmentalists, those that are concerned with new technology and oil spill. This could bring and bridge a void that's been severely damaged as a consequence of this spill, and get people together and get new contingency and containment plans that'll work because the local people are involved.
And a lot of these problems have been around for years and years. Mr. Frampton, from the environmental community's point of view, do you think Congress really appreciates the dangers here and is going to do something about it?
Well, I hope so, Peter. I think that those listening to this program ought to know that while the Senate has passed very strong oil spill liability legislation, creating a large fund and allowing the states to impose unlimited liability on top of that fund, the House of Representatives this week and next will consider several bills which are basically sponsored by the shipping industry and the oil industry that are worse than current law, that would cut back on the incentives that oil companies would have to invest in safety and prevention, that would prevent any state liability from being imposed, that are worse than current law in several other respects, including limiting liability to very small dollar figures. And there will be substitute legislation that's good legislation introduced, but I expect that there will be a real dogfight over this in the next 2 weeks in the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. All right, this Peter? Will be open again for calls. If you have a question for any of these gentlemen, George Frampton, Senator Frank Murkowski, or Theo Pulasic, the number is 800-325-1100. And Pat, Corey, have you got callers on the lineup there?
Well, this is Corey Potoff in Anchorage, and we'd like to ask you to please stay with us there in Washington. We'd like to try to tune in on Alaska Beach now.
That's right. Through the miracle of technology, we are going to try to hook up with a hearty group of volunteers who are based in Homer, who are working on the beach recovery effort, at least through the next month. They're from the Homer Area Recovery Coalition, and they are based in a wilderness area known as Mars Cove. We're going to try to hook up with those folks through a ham operator whose name is John Stannard. John, are you with us?
With you.
Well, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. As you said, I'm an amateur radio operator, and my call is KL7JL. And if you'll stand by just a moment, I will try to put you in contact with the Mars Cove group, the Summer Area Recovery Coalition in Fort Dick. Stand by. NL7KZ, NL7KZ, this is KL7JL. You are on the air, and is your group ready to talk?
Yes, good morning, Alaska. This is Ben Levine calling from Mars Cove in the west arm of Port Dick.
I'm here with Bill Day, working with the Coma Area Recovery Coalition, a volunteer beach cleanup effort. And we have three questions, which we'd like to handle one at a time, please. Over.
Go ahead.
Directed to Mr. Harrison, we'd like to know how you feel about our group of volunteers here in Mars Cove staying through October to continue the beach cleanup program, which the Exxon Corporation has curtailed.
I'm sorry, Mr. Harrison is not with us. Here in the studio in Anchorage, we have Mr. Theo Palasek from Alyeska Pipeline Company. But maybe you can respond.
I don't know the answer to that. I'll talk to Mr. Harrison with that.
Okay, please go on with your other questions, though.
Go ahead, Ben.
We'd like to know how you feel about our group of volunteers here in Mars Cove staying through October to continue the beach cleanup program, which the Exxon Corporation has curtailed. Over.
Mr. Palasek, would you like to comment?
Well, really, that's an excellent call, and I think they talked very clearly earlier, I don't know, about safety concerns. I don't know enough about the local situation to comment on.
Perhaps what we could do is ask you folks out there in Mars Cove, Ben Levine and Bill Day, if you could update us on the progress you are making as volunteers. You've been bringing in volunteers from all over the globe. Many people aren't aware of the activity that you're doing out there. You've created your own environmentally safe cleanup operation to spray rocks out there. We saw what you were doing just the other day, flew out to Homer. And perhaps our national audience could just get an update on where you are and what you're doing. Over.
We didn't hear the whole question there, but Bill Day to give you an update on our progress here in Mars Cove. Here's Bill. This is Bill Day here, and I only understood part of that question, so I'll answer what I can. We've been working approximately the last 3 weeks with our cleaning procedures. We're working on a beach approximately 175 feet. We've cleaned approximately 5 tons of rock and 2 tons of sediment using our rock washing system, some of you may have already heard of. We have cleaned approximately a 20-foot by a 60-foot section.
Bill Day, you are the inventor of this rock washing program. Perhaps you can tell us what it is. Something that Exxon has done, that environmentalists are concerned about, is that they've used a hot water wash and chemicals directly on the beach. You, on the other hand, have done something a little different. You've taken buckets of rocks and removed them from the beach and run them through what looks like a barbecue and spray them with hot water. How does that compare, would you say, to the Exxon plan of cleanup?
Our main difference is that we're picking up only the oily rock, working in only the areas that are oiled already, and removing them from the area and putting them into a contained environment for cleaning. That way we're not spraying hot water on the organisms that aren't affected by the oil.
Thank you. That at least gives us a sense of the incredible difficulty that it takes to really clean these beaches. We'd like to thank you. That's the volunteer cleanup crew at Mars Cove. And go on and create opportunities for more people to call in. The number here is 800. That's 800-325-1100. You can take calls from all over the country. We'd like to go on to our connection in Washington, D.C., where Peter Kenyon is standing by.
Corey, I'm here with George Frampton, President of the Wilderness Society, and Alaska Senator Frank Murkowski. Mr. Frampton, earlier Otto Harrison said that Exxon's embarking on what he called the most intensive science program in the world this winter. Early reports from an oil spill conference up in Seattle suggested that the science had not been rigorous enough to learn very many lessons from this spill. Are you satisfied that Exxon's doing everything it can to learn from this disaster?
Well, Peter, I think we'll learn a great deal, but I think it'll be too late for this spill. My experience in being up there and talking to Coast Guard, Exxon, state people, and fishermen has been that the technology in this field has not changed much, has not improved much in 20 years, and that our technology is actually behind that of other countries. When the local fishermen went to look for good absorbent booms, good skimmers, they found that technology was available in the North Sea, in Scandinavia, in the Soviet Union, very often, but not in the United States. I think that tells us something about other countries' interest in protecting their maritime environments relative to the interest we've shown in the past.
Senator Murkowski, what about prevention equipment and tanker safety? You know, major issues that have been around for 10, 15 years or longer and have failed to move either at the Coast Guard level or the congressional level. Even again this year, an amendment to require double bottoms failed in the Senate. Are we ever going to see these measures?
Well, you are going to see these measures. The question is ultimately what measures should be taken, and the idea of a double bottom has been around for a long time. In the case of the Exxon Valdez, a double bottom would not have made any difference. The penetration of Playa Reef was such that it would have gone through probably three bottoms.
I thought the Coast Guard had said that up to 60% of it might have remained on the ship.
Well, if you look at how much remained on the ship, there was about 25% that spilled. The rest was recovered. The fact is, a double bottom, and the information I have, wouldn't do the trick. This ship went aground in about a 10.5-mile channel. There's no excuse for the vessel going aground, but it did go aground. It's like the Titanic. It sunk. It wasn't supposed to sink. You're going to have maritime disasters when you move as much oil as we move in the United States by vessel. That's all there is to it. Now, we can reduce that, and that's what we have to learn from that experience, and that's the purpose of my legislation and much of the legislation that's been introduced in Congress, to try and reduce the risk.
Thank you. We have a caller on the line now from Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., if you can hear us, please go ahead with your question.
Yes, my name's Jeff Gard. I have a question for Mr. Pomaski. Dealing with the dedicated oil spill response team that Alyeska had there in the past, why it was dismantled, why the containment barge they had for oil was not certified. They'd known about this for a couple of years. They did nothing to replace it or get it certified. And why it took 72 hours to get any real response out there from Alyeska when their own contingency plan and memos to the State Department of Environmental Conservation said they could completely remove from the environment a 200,000 barrel oil spill in 48 hours.
Well, let me first listen. Many faceted question. Let me start with the part about not being out there and not doing anything for 72 hours. That's just not true, because we had taken out all of the equipment required and had all of the boom that was required to be deployed on Friday. By Saturday, we'd taken out another 3 miles worth of boom and had that deployed on Saturday. So we had greatly exceeded what the plan required us to do on initial response. But our boom was put out at the leading edge of the oil spill, which essentially is 6 miles from the vessel. So anyone standing on the vessel would say, where is Alyeska? We were working at the leading edge of the oil spill, and we protected Live Reef Island and Bly Island itself as part of our boom. So we essentially deployed our boom, contained the spill, which we did before the winds came up Sunday, to protect the lands nearby and to deflect the oil in a direction that would make it amenable for dispersant application. And that's what we did. That was our strategy that we had with the limited resources we had, which were not designed for a catastrophic spill. I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions here. People have the idea that we had a plan that was designed to deal with a catastrophic spill. It's not true. We had a plan designed to deal with the most likely spill, which was what the state law required, which is what we agreed upon with the state. And everybody understood that going into this thing, but all of a sudden, the expectations now are much higher. So, therefore, in the future, all oil spill plans around the country, I think, will be modified by this experience. The point about us presumably doing away with the oil spill response group is not correct. In 82, we had four contract-type people who worked as oil spill response people, doing some other minor chores around, essentially dedicated to that. We decided that we would make those four people, you know, essentially we took out of the 12 that would constitute 3 8-hour shifts, there were 12 people, we took about 8 of them and made them permanent Alyeska employees, increasing the number of technicians we had. And those four technicians then, the primary job was oil spill response. At the same time, we then took all the rest of the Marine techs and trained them as oil spill response people. So we in effect went from 12 people to well over 100 people who were trained in varying degrees to help us in oil spill response. And we demonstrated that in January and we picked up 1,700 barrels.
Colin, does that answer your question?
I guess we have a difference of opinion here. I was out there flying over the spill for the first 5 days and didn't see Alyeska out there. It doesn't address their problem with their containment barge, and it doesn't address the problem that their immediate response equipment was stored away in a warehouse and nobody was cut loose to go help drag it out of the warehouse. But a single crane operator who had to operate the crane, the forklift, and move everything down to the dock to get it there. But there was a memo to the State Department of Environmental Conservation, I believe, dated August of 85, and I may be wrong in the date, but it did unequivocally state that Alyeska could deal with the 200,000 barrel oil spill within 48 hours and have it out of the environment. And I don't know if 200,000 barrels differs from a catastrophic spill as to where we had 240,000 in this one.
I don't know where you got that number, but there was no document, to my knowledge, at any time frame like that ever referencing 200,000 barrels. I don't know what you're talking about.
We're going to have to move on in any case. We have another caller, Peter.
Is there a caller from Alexandria, Virginia? Virginia, are you on the line? Can you hear us?
I'd like to ask the man from Alyeska or anybody that's sitting there in Washington. I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and I want to know why no one has proposed the federal government truly taking over and doing the cleanup, because obviously this is the worst disaster that we've ever seen of that nature, and it just seems like it would ensure that we cut out all the bureaucratic red tape of what has Exxon done, and now the question will be, what has the federal government done? And that is something that federal taxpayers can look at and make sure happens, and I just want to know what they think about that and why no one has actually done that.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Frampton, go right ahead.
Under current law, the federal government has the authority to take over, and I think in retrospect it's a tragedy that that wasn't done in this case. The local communities, the state and the federal government could have handled this in all likelihood much better than Exxon. I think, though, that the federal government was afraid that the money wouldn't be there. And that's why we need legislation. The fact is that federal takeover of cleanup is not a solution to this problem. As long as we don't have the incentives for the companies themselves to change their ways and make the necessary investments, federal involvement is not going to be a guarantee that this kind of thing won't continue to happen over and over again.
All right, thank you very much.
I'd like to comment very briefly on that.
Very briefly.
Because under the Clean Water Act, of course, whoever perpetrates a spill is responsible for it. Now, the federal government is going to hold Exxon responsible, and that's been made very, very clear.
Okay.
EPA Director Riley said if it's not cleaned up and they don't clean it up, we'll simply clean it up and bill them back. So
thank you very much. We have to go back to Anchorage now.
Nationwide call-in. is a production of the Alaska Public Radio Network, with support from the Town Creek Foundation and American Express.
The number to call to participate in today's nationwide oil spill call-in show is 800-325-1100. That number again is 800-325-1100. I'm Pat Bodner in Anchorage.
And I'm Corey Flintoff. In a moment, we'll rejoin Peter Kenyon in the nation's capital for a discussion of oil spill legislation. But first, we'd like to take a few moments to introduce a topic that's very familiar to Alaskan listeners, but may not be very well known in the rest of the nation. The word is subsistence. It's hunting season in Alaska, and that's a time when Alaska natives are working hard to store away food for the winter. Along the coast, they've been busy gathering the abundant sea life found on craggy rocks and under the steel blue waters. But the Chugach natives in south central Alaska have been spending their subsistence season in a vain attempt to scrape sludge off beaches and rid their fishing grounds of oil. This has brought a substantial income to some. But as Gary Fife reports, there's been a price to pay. Some Alaska natives don't know if they'll have enough food to last through the winter.
I wish deep inside they could understand that the people here in English Bay depend on subsistence. And the other people that subsist day-to-day basis to survive, and it's very important for those people.
There are no supermarkets in these coastal towns. Instead, James Kvasnikov and his father Vincent go to the beach when the tide's low for their groceries. They also subsist on three kinds of salmon, seal, seaweed, octopus, and bottom fish such as halibut year-round.
It's like the Vidarki castle. We just put the Vidarki in and mix it with rice and seaweed and snails and add a little bit of seal oil and garlic and, you know, really toss it around, and that's a really mouth-watering meal.
It's too expensive to fly in groceries, and since most residents don't work for wages, they simply don't have the money to spend. Eleanor McMullen lives around the point in Fort Graham. She sits on the tribal council and is the main health care provider in the village.
I probably could compare it to a farmer that wasn't able to process their vegetables and whatever that they raised. If they weren't able to do that and still lived on the farm, they would be at a great loss.
The urge to fish is overwhelming. It's like browsing the food shelves while your stomach's growling, knowing that you can't buy anything because it might be poisoned. Even if the fish had been safe to harvest, no one would have had the time. They were too busy working for Exxon. Vico, the company Exxon hired to provide cleanup workers, invaded the villages in April.
It was like a nightmare.
McMullen witnessed it firsthand in Port Graham.
All one day in our village was its normal self. And then the next day, there were people, hordes of people everywhere. Everybody was excited. They were getting jobs. You know, $16 an hour was really impressive. And people were quitting their normal jobs, going to work for Vico, jobs that they usually treasured and fought for and tried to keep. They gave up immediately.
In an effort to soften the blow to this year's subsistence harvest, Exxon has purchased 40,000 pounds of fish. That's a lot, but it doesn't compare to what would have been harvested if the spill hadn't occurred.